It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Excuse me.
Got lots to cover, so we're just going to dive right in.
Splat.
Yeah. The water has receded, Job.
Oops. My head hurts. Actually, it's my neck.
Must be the cold.
Yeah.
Palestine, they had elections this last week. Tell us about that.
They did have elections, and they've already had everything go to heck in a handbasket over there, unfortunately. It's kind of a grim situation. There was a suicide bombing Thursday night, and so the newly elected prime minister of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, has already had all ties to his government severed by the Sharon administration of Israel. This is something that's just happened in the last 24 hours as a result of the suicide bombing. And also Israel took the additional step of closing off the Gaza Strip, the three checkpoints that connect it with Egypt and Israel, so that there's no ability to get food, medicine, supplies into or out of, for that matter, the Gaza Strip. This is something that's really pretty discouraging. Abbas is very much between a rock and a hard place. He has vowed on the one hand to seek peace talks with Israel and to try and he's fudged a little bit on this issue, but he's certainly talked about trying to take on the militants who have been fueling the Intifada for 4 years now in Palestine. But he does not have the ability to control them. You don't have the ability to control what every person and the whole of your land does, and this is the standard by which the Sharon government is trying to hold him, with the complicity of the Bush administration, which is basically standing by and holding its hands while all this takes place. It's a discouraging situation. It's unclear where things go from here. What Israel is saying is that we will not negotiate, we will not even try to set up the terms for potential peace talks, restore the ties to the Palestinian Authority until all terror attacks have stopped, which has pretty much always been their bottom line. But it's an impossible bottom line to hold to. It's a bottom line that ensures that there will never be peace talks, and you will always have this sort of ongoing cycle of violence. Once again, the Bush administration has done very little to try and hold Israel's feet to the fire, to try and get them to the negotiating table and try and interrupt this cycle, and you know, the military occupation of Gaza and the West Bank continues.
All right. Moving over to Indonesia, the heart of the tsunami.
Yes, the Indonesian government issued an order this week that all aid groups, aid workers, journalists, and foreigners in the province of Aceh and on Sumatra Island had to register with the Indonesian government before they could go outside of the capital city of Banda Aceh, of the province of Aceh. And that's put that's hampered aid workers in the worst hit area of the tsunami. And it's left people scratching their heads. You know, why would the Indonesian military do this? There's not any danger that aid workers have run across. No one's been injured. There's been a little bit of shooting between military troops and Achenese rebels, but the Achenese rebels have, since the tsunami hit, they declared a unilateral ceasefire, which, by the way, the Indonesian government has not formally accepted on their side of the deal. So it is unilateral. It is the rebels who have declared the ceasefire.
And as we've talked about in previous weeks, the Indonesian military has actually used the aid distribution as a cover to launch some attacks against the guerrillas.
Yeah, and that's what some of the shooting has been. So there have been no attacks against foreigners, aid workers, journalists, UN observers, nobody. So there is really no danger, and the Achenese rebels have said that they will not attack aid workers or foreigners in the country because of the devastation, because of the need, the vast need for help. So the press and analysts are going, well, why has the Indonesian government and the Indonesian military said that there has to be this registration program and banned movement to certain parts of the province of Aceh? And what they've concluded is that the Indonesian government is afraid that what happened in East Timor is going to happen in Aceh. And by that I mean aid workers and journalists helped the East Timor people out quite a bit, not just with aid, but also with help with their movement towards democracy. And the Indonesian government is afraid that this tsunami disaster and the fact that there are so many UN workers and journalists and aid workers in Aceh province will open up what the Indonesian military has been doing there in the past 5 or 6 years since the Acehese independence movement started up again. They're afraid that the Indonesian military's massacre of some 10,000 civilians in Aceh province will become widespread news, and that the hopes for freedom of the Acehese people will become a cause not just within Indonesia, but an international cause, and that this could lead to a referendum like it did in East Timor. And so these moves to ban movement by UN workers and aid workers outside of the capital of Aceh province, and also another move, the Indonesian government said that all foreign troops, U.S. troops and Japanese troops are there right now helping to transport some of the aid, that all foreign troops are going to have to leave Sumatra Island by the end of March, which is probably far too soon for real reconstruction to even begin, much less finish.
Yeah. Important things to this is it's not just the ability of foreigners to help out the Acehese, it's the ability of the Acehese to tell their stories to foreigners. And this is something that happened in East Timor as well. The precedent where the tremendous, you know, genocidal levels of massacres that happened against the East Timorese was something that was not widely known in the rest of the world until the East Timorese had started to get the opportunity to tell their story to the outside world. And this is something that the Indonesian government is very much concerned about.
Yes. And that, I'm assuming, is why they would have included journalists in the ban as well as aid workers.
All right, well, that takes us to This Week in Iraq.
It was reported this week that ballots being printed for the elections at the end of this month, which is only a couple of weeks away, lack the names of any candidates running for the National Assembly in Iraq. The identities of the candidates are secret to protect them from assassination by the insurgents. How then are the Iraqis supposed to vote? Know who to vote for?
Did we misplace the laugh track with this?
I'm looking for it.
It gets better. The Iraqis won't be voting for individual candidates, but for parties. They'll select from a list of about 111 political parties, each one of which has registered a list of candidates with the Electoral Commission. According to the percentage of vote that each party receives, the Electoral Commission will then decide how many candidates from each party will get a seat on the assembly. So it's much like you or I going to the polls and voting, checking a box for either Democrat, Republican, or Green Party, or Libertarian, except they're are going to be a lot more choices in the Iraqi election. But there's only one problem with this. The platforms of most of these parties are also being kept secret to avoid attacks from the insurgents. So this is where the lag track is supposed to kick in again. Not only will Iraqis not know who to vote for, they may not know where to vote, even in relatively peaceful areas, because guess what? The locations of polling places are being kept secret until the last minute. So just days or perhaps even just a week before the election, people won't even know where to go to vote. Now, even if Iraqis can find or reach their polling places, which is not a sure thing with the situation, with the security situation as it is, with some neighborhoods of Baghdad being very, very violence prone while others are not, there will only be an average of about 5 voting booths at each polling place, which is not going to be enough. Now, because the registration has been so low in many places, election officials will allow Iraqis to fill out provisional ballots at any polling place, regardless of where they live, So even if you don't know where the polling place is in your neighborhood, you can go to another neighborhood and vote there. There's a problem with that. The Electoral Commission hasn't explained exactly how they're going to keep people from voting twice or three times or as many times as they want. And this has left the system completely open to fraud, particularly for the parties who are in the government right now and have access to the list of polling places. They and their supporters will know where all of the polling places are, whereas many ordinary Iraqis may have a difficult time figuring out where they're supposed to vote, much less who, which party to vote for.
That's remarkable.
It is absolutely remarkable, and it is very.
We're exporting democracy. Is that right?
Yes, and it is very similar to how the selection process went for the original assembly, not the governing council, which was appointed by the U.S. and the U.N., but for the assembly that took over from them. Supposedly, there were these caucuses that were set up, and people were supposed to be able to come and participate, but the caucuses were set up in secret places, and certain people were invited to participate, and others were kept out, and it was...
Was there a secret knock that you had to know in order to get in the door?
You probably had a password you needed to know in order to get in the door. I mean, it's a farce. But meanwhile, the U.S. and the interim government have admitted that voting will probably not take place in four provinces. Well, at least four provinces. And those four provinces are mostly in Sunni territory. But here's the interesting thing. The U.S. government and the interim government have both said that 45% of the population live in these primarily Sunni areas. Yes. That's right. No one has explained how the Sunnis, how the Sunnis could be considered a 20% minority population of the country and still form the majority of people in four provinces that hold almost half of the population of the country. Clearly, a census is desperately needed, although it is certainly not possible with the security situation the way it is. This discrepancy in numbers may also explain why the insurgency has been so tough to deal with if the U.S. government is continually underestimating the number of Sunnis in the population as a whole. Excuse me. Now, the final thing I want to talk about for this week in Iraq is there's a debate going on within the Pentagon about a new strategy to defeat the insurgency, and people may have read about this. It was widely reported in the news this week. The new plan is called the Salvador Option, where the U.S. military arms and finances death squads as they did in El Salvador in the 1980s. Now, that shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone, since George W. Bush has resurrected a number of Reagan-era officials who were involved in the Central American counterinsurgency programs.
Yeah, Negroponte
is the ambassador to Iraq and he was the ambassador to Honduras in the 1980s during the counterinsurgency programs, which, by the way, killed over 100,000 civilians in countries like El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. Now, the plan is to heavily arm Shiite militias or Kurdish Peshmerga, to hunt down Sunni insurgents and their sympathizers, which means when they use the word sympathizers, they mean a general terror campaign against Sunni civilians. So that's women, children, everybody. Just like it happened in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala. Of course, the only thing that might stop the Pentagon from implementing this horrible plan is direct public pressure on the Bush administration and the civilian leadership of the Pentagon. So I'm urging people to call or write to the president, the vice president, and to Donald Rumsfeld's office. And not just to Donald Rumsfeld, but to Paul Wolfowitz, his deputy director, who I think is the real brains behind Donald Rumsfeld, and Douglas Feith, the undersecretary for policy, who I think is probably the biggest proponent of this plan. It's difficult to reach them by email, so I encourage people to do the good old-fashioned handwritten letter, which I think has a lot more impact than a typewritten letter or an email or a phone call. And it's very easy to find the addresses. You can look them up on the web, or they're pretty widely available. The White House address is 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest, and the zip code is 20500.
Yeah, and I would add to that that I think it's a reasonably good idea to start pressuring Democratic lawmakers on this also. That they,
well,
they
Congress
need to
may not have any say in this kind of a thing.
They have a bully pulpit, though.
Yeah.
They have a pulpit that we don't have.
And they're in charge of, I mean, they have some say in the funding for this whole thing. So
not really.
I mean, depending on who gets to run it, there's a debate going on in the Pentagon over who's going to get to run it, the Defense Department or the CIA. If the CIA runs it, you know, the money will come out of their general black budget that nobody sees and very few people get to vote on. So it just depends. And the way the Bush administration has run this war is to get a blank check from Congress in these emergency appropriations and then turn around and use them for whatever. They could just divert some money from a portion of the defense budget to
run
it.
That's true, but their future blank checks could be cut. I mean, it might not be a direct cut on this particular plan, but Congress theoretically still holds the strings to the money flow.
You're right. And the Bush administration is going to be asking for another $80 billion to $90 billion in this next year, probably sometime after the inauguration has happened.
Yeah, I was going to say they'll probably just transfer the money directly from the inauguration fundraising since it's all a big party to them anyway.
Well, that wouldn't pay for it all. It's only $40 million for the inauguration, and they're going to need a lot more than that for Iraq. But, they're going to be asking for more
money. I was just thinking for the death squads in particular, death squads inauguration party. It's the same kind of thing.
I see where you're going with it.
All
yeah.
Right. Anything
but,
else?
Yeah, they're eventually going to have to ask Congress for money. So, But right now, I think it's better for people to say this is just not acceptable and to tell the Bush administration that directly.
All right. Anything else on Iraq?
Nope, let's move on.
All right. Well, staying international, but moving to north of the border, looks like Canada is discovering some more mad cows.
Yeah, it's interesting. There was a new case of the first case of mad cow disease that closed the border was back in May of last year. The Bush administration decided that come January they were going to reopen exports of Canadian beef into the U.S. So, What happened on January 2nd is another mad cow case was confirmed in Canada. It was a cow that was born before the ban on the feed ban, which would have supposedly protected Canadian herds from exposure to mad cow disease. But then, about 10 days after that, in January, just about a week ago, another case of mad cow disease was discovered. And what was very disturbing about this third case was that the cow was born after the feed ban was put into effect, which means that the current screening of cows born before the feed ban is not adequate for catching all the mad cow cases that could be out there. In addition, this third cow did not exhibit any signs of the disease. She did not, and I'll say that again, she did not exhibit any external signs of the disease. So the policy we have in the United States of testing cows born before a certain date and cows that exhibit signs of the disease is clearly not adequate. So I think that's something we should pay attention to. And also we should pay attention to the fact the Bush administration is still going to lift the ban, regardless of the fact that these two
on Canadian beef imports
Right.
you're talking about.
Right. Regardless of the fact that these two new cases have cropped up, and one of them is a very disturbing case. So, something people should be thinking about when they go to the store to buy, whether they should choose chicken or beef or a vegetarian option.
Chicken. All right.
Tofu.
Moving along. The Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, shred the Constitution, get a promotion. It's the hallmark of the Bush administration, and it happened again this week with Michael Chertoff. He is the new nominee to run the Department of Homeland Security now that Bernard Kerik has gone down in flames. And this is considered a relatively safe nominee in terms of his confirmation by the Senate. He was already nominated to a judgeship last year, in which he was confirmed by an 88-1 vote. The one no vote came from Hillary Clinton because Chertoff was a senior counsel in the Senate panel that investigated Whitewater. But Chertoff has a number of other disturbing things in his closet. Before he took on the judgeship last year, that was his previous promotion from working in the Justice Department, where, among other things, he was responsible in the days and weeks after 9/11 for the roundup of Asian and Muslim and North African, mostly men, several hundred of them who languished in jail for an average of 3 months each, with a policy of hold until clear. That is to say that these people who were detained basically because of their ethnicity, basically because the FBI was panicked about the possibility of sleeper cells in the United States. They were presumed guilty until proven innocent. Was the standard that Chertoff used for this? This is a man now who is going to coordinate all Homeland Security for the United States. In addition, it's worth noting that with the roundup that happened on Chertoff's watch, that nobody was ever actually accused of a crime, let alone convicted. There were no actual terrorist-related crimes coming out of that roundup. It was all piddling immigration violations or visa violations of one sort or another. This is another nominee that should draw close attention from the Senate, but probably will not in terms of the Democrats that should be questioning him closely as they should have, but really didn't very much with Alberto Gonzalez.
Speaking of Gonzalez, how is his process going?
He's almost certain to be nominated. The hearings are all but complete now, and the vote will happen probably next week, I believe.
Wasn't there a little aside you were telling me a minute ago about him?
There was a fascinating testimony in the Gonzalez hearing last week from a gentleman. I believe he was a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania or something like that, who had worked in the Clinton administration, who was and who had a job in the White House under Clinton, working in law, same sort of stuff that Gonzalez did in the first Bush term, who was talking about the definition of torture that Gonzalez crafted, the one that defined that interrogation techniques were okay so long as they did not result in pain equaling organ failure or death, and how narrow a definition that is, that most of the techniques that were used by the secret police under Saddam Hussein did not fall under that category, that they would have been okay under the Bush administration's definition of what constituted torture. So that when you heard Gonzalez and when
you
heard Bush...
So they would not be considered torture. Right.
Exactly. So that when you heard Gonzalez and you heard Bush say, we won't abide torture, we don't countenance torture, we don't do torture in the United States, you have to ask them what they mean by torture, because what they're excluding when they talk about torture includes a whole lot of unpleasant things. And, you know, this is the same folks who are now talking about death squads in Iraq. It's really very, very disturbing stuff.
All right. Well, speaking of disturbing stuff, it came out in the news this week that the University of Washington, apparently you potentially going to be getting something out of it whether you go there or not. They're proposing a bioterrorism lab on the campus.
Yeah, the University of Washington made this little announcement. Actually, they were applying for the permits and the money for it in secret. They had not approved it with the faculty senate or made any kind of public announcement, and it just kind of got leaked that they were looking for funds to build a bioterrorism lab, and I believe it's a level 3 lab that could handle things like botulinum toxin and anthrax and some very nasty stuff that you wouldn't want to escape and be in your population. The problem is that it's going to be here within a city, a heavily populated area. And that there was no public kind of approval process or any kind of environmental impact statement. Or any kind of public notification. So you've got the faculty senate is up in arms, and public groups in the university district are up in arms, and I think the whole city ought to be concerned about this.
Yeah, I agree, and I think one of the biggest irony of all this is while everyone's getting upset about that and focusing on this potential lab going on the U, they have already snuck one in down on in Belltown on Western, a BSL level 3 plus lab. that went through without any public input. And
it is also highly secret.
It's highly secret, and they're going to be handling BSL level 4 pathogens there.
Which includes, doesn't that include the Ebola virus?
It does, but the one that they are definitely funding for working on there is the influenza virus of 1918. They went out and dug
that up. The killer influenza virus,
and they're going to be spraying that on macaque monkeys there in the heart of Belltown. So,
yeah, memo to ALF, don't release that.
So people have multiple reasons for being disturbed about that. All right. Well, it's a busy week coming up. Multiple events for people to go to. And one of them is tonight. Mike Rupert, who I had an interview last week with on this show. He's going to be speaking tonight at Kane Hall from 7 to 10 o'clock. I believe tickets are still available, but they are moving. So you can get those at the door. And, you know, get there early. Keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah, tomorrow night there's a world premiere of the movie Hope in Hard Times, which is about the Argentinian revolution of 2 years ago. That's happening at the Seattle Art Museum. Tickets are $10 in advance, $12 at the door. And I believe that's a fundraiser for the Community Alliance for Global Justice. But the filmmakers will be present and taking answers afterwards and all that. Monday morning, as usual, on MLK Day, we have the workshops and the march at Garfield High School. Do you have the exact times on that? I think the workshops are 9:30.
Workshops start at 9:30. There is a rally at 11, and then the march begins at 12.
And where is the march going this year?
You know, I'm not actually sure on that. I just have the start times and the start place.
Well, it's going somewhere.
We just can follow the person in front of
that's
you.
That's right. And then, of course, on Thursday, we have the inauguration. And with the inauguration, there will also be a counter-inauguration. And that's happening down at Westlake Park. And what are the times on that?
Well, there's actually, there's two things
there's
happening.
There's two of them.
There's one at Westlake Park at 2 o'clock. And then at 5 o'clock, there's one at the Federal Building.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I guess one is for... the later one's for if you've got a job, and the earlier one is for, you know, if you don't. Or you
or
get an extended lunch or something like that. So.
Yeah, or you can get out of your job.
So plenty of things tonight, tomorrow, Monday, and Thursday.
Yeah, keep busy.
That's right. Wear a warm coat.
We've planned your week for you.
Wear a raincoat. They're predicting rain.
Yeah, layers. Layers is the key. All right. Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchek, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks. It's a free newspaper that comes out around town, and I want to take a moment also to thank people for their donations in our recent pledge drive. We did pretty well on it and wanted to just extend our thanks. You can still make donations, of course, but we won't hammer you on it this week the way we have past weeks. You can also volunteer. It's a largely volunteer publication. Writers, distributors, ad salespeople, anything like that that you feel like you can help out with the publication, we can always use it. You can see our entire back issues and our current issue online and information on all that stuff at our website. It's www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.